But right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Jin-Hee Lee. She's Assistant Counsel of the Criminal Justice Practice Group at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Jin-Hee, thanks so much for being on our program tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida, by an armed neighborhood watch volunteer on February 26th has provoked protests all over this country. It has also sparked many discussions on talk radio, heated discussions, and analysis by police, attorneys, and the general public about the issues involved in this case, maybe most importantly, the issue of racial profiling. But, Jin-Hee Lee, from your perspective at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, maybe you can talk about the particulars of this case that concern you beyond the specific individuals involved. As tragic as it is, there are some wider implications here that I know you're focusing on.
Yes. One of the main concerns that we have here at the Legal Defense Fund, and especially in the Criminal Justice Practice Group, has been the criminalization of people of color. And when I say that, what I mean is the assumptions and prejudices and stereotypes of assuming that a person who is primarily black or Latino is being having criminal tendencies, that they're more likely to be a criminal. And this is a result of long-standing racism in our criminal justice institutions. It's also evident in, you know, media perceptions of black and Latinos, especially young black and Latino men. And the consequences can be very tragic, as what happened to Trayvon Martin.
As you look at the facts of this case, where there has to date been no arrests of George Zimmerman here in this case, tell us about the reasons you think there has been no arrest here. At some point, to Florida's Stand Your Ground law as a justification for the police not taking action. But it appears in some recent news reports that there had been an initial police report requesting an arrest warrant for negligent homicide and unnecessary manslaughter, but apparently people higher up in the system basically knocked that idea down.
And the fact that the way that this case has been handled is a real reflection, again, of common perceptions, common misperceptions, and again, stereotypes of people like Trayvon Martin, because at the end of the day, he was a 17-year-old who was carrying Skittles and a can of iced tea, and to be gunned down on the street, and for there to be no repercussions for that, and for people to kind of assume that the killing, or even to as the Sanford police has put forward, that this killing was justified, kind of belies the fact that what we had here was a student. The automatic impression of who this person was is an innocent student who was walking home at night from a grocery store, from a convenience store, and instead to even presume that this killing was justified automatically taints the impression of this young man as someone who was dangerous or was putting George Zimmerman at risk of danger. And again, this really kind of highlights the ingrained stereotypes that we have of young black men like Trayvon Martin.
You know, a lot of people have talked about a different scenario in this tragic case, where if a 17-year-old black male such as Trayvon Martin had killed the 28-year-old George Zimmerman on the neighborhood watch volunteer, there's no doubt, I think, in most people's mind that Trayvon would have been arrested right quick. And even though there is a record of arrests for George Zimmerman, assaulting a police officer, domestic violence, it seems clear that he wasn't arrested, and Trayvon would have been if the tables were turned, as an indicator that, you know, there's something wrong in our system here.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, there's just an incident happened a few years ago in Long Island, actually, along the lines of what you just described, where a father, a black father, was confronted with a young white man who was yelling racial epithets and was trying to attack his son, and he shot and killed that young white man in self-defense, saying that this person was attacking him and attacking his son. And unlike the situation of George Zimmerman, he was immediately arrested and prosecuted for killing that person. And just as you said, when you juxtapose those two incidents, it's remarkable the way that the police have handled the situation, that that George Zimmerman was not immediately arrested, that he wasn't investigated, that there weren't immediate questioning of witnesses to get down to get to the heart of what happened, but instead to just kind of assume that that it was in self-defense, and again that assumption that it was in self-defense assumes that Trayvon Martin was the person who was dangerous in that situation.
Our guest tonight is Jinhee Lee, Assistant Counsel of the Criminal Justice Practice Group at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Jinhee Lee, tell us about the particulars of the accusations that the Sanford Police Department are guilty of some very sloppy investigative work here in terms of looking into the background of George Zimmerman, the shooter in this case, who killed Trayvon Martin, and the lack of questions to some key witnesses, including Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, who was on a cell phone with him just minutes before he was shot and killed.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of criticisms about the way the police has handled this, and especially when you think about the seriousness of what happened, that a young person was shot and killed, and for them to not take the investigation seriously and to take all steps to figure out what happened and to preserve evidence and to question George Zimmerman right away, right after the incident, all of those things really it's an unfortunate indication of how little the police valued Trayvon Martin's life, that he was a victim in that situation, and that it was their responsibility to really determine what happened to him that night.
In looking at what's transpired since the family got in touch with a network of national activists, there's been a ruckus raised about the lack of an arrest in this case, lack of a thorough investigation, and the governor of Florida appointed a special state prosecutor, Angela Corey, recently, and the family, the lawyers for the family, have called for the U.S. Justice Department to get involved. What's the position of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund on this? What should happen next here?
No, I don't think that we have, as an organization, have an official position, but I would like to comment that it is unfortunate that that the family and the people who are concerned about getting to the truth have to rely on a special prosecutor and the Department of Justice, the federal government, to step in and make sure that the Sanford police and state authorities are doing what they are supposed to be doing. I mean, this kind of it kind of reminds us of back in the days of segregation or the states' rights movements when state governments were ignoring the mandates of our Constitution, and for the federal government to step in to make sure that justice is done. And for that to happen again here in 2012 really highlights the fact that race is still a serious issue, even though things have changed over the past several decades. But again, that the fact that the federal government is asked to step in to make sure that rights are vindicated is a sign that we have a long way to go.
There was a case that recently got national attention, and it was a 60-year-old black man, Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., who was a 68-year-old veteran of the U.S. Marines. He was killed in his home by the police in White Plains, New York. This was back in November of 2011. Apparently, his medical alert device went off. The police came there. He said it was an accident, that he wasn't in need of any help, and the short story that the son of the slain father tells is that the police were very aggressive about getting in the apartment, and he basically told them, "I don't have a problem here. You can leave." And there was a confrontation, and they shot this man dead for just the idea that they wouldn't allow him in the apartment for what was supposed to be initially just a medical emergency that was a false alarm. I don't know if you've heard about this case, but there are a lot of presumptions by the police, and even in a case like this, which reflects the horror that a lot of people face when police with guns come looking for them for whatever reason, on the idea that a black male, whoever they are, whatever age, is extremely dangerous, and the only way to deal them was with heavy weapons. I'm not sure if you've heard this case again, but I don't know if you would want to comment on it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the details of that case, but when you spoke, it reminded me of an incident here in New York City in the Bronx, where Marley Graham, which was a young man who was chased by police officers into his home and was shot and killed in his own bathroom. And all he had on him purportedly was the chase was, well, the only thing that was found on him was some marijuana, but to be chased after by police officers and to be shot and killed in your own bathroom, it is a very serious situation for a lot of young, I mean, primarily young black and Latino men to fear for their lives in several encounters with police officers. And we have a class action lawsuit here in New York City challenging some police practices in public housing, and we've heard from several residents that in many cases they're more afraid of police officers than they are of drug dealers or other people engaged in criminal activity, and that's a sorry state of affairs, because it really is, when you think about it, the police officers are supposed to be there to protect them, and the fact that people are afraid of them really tells you it's a sad situation.
One of the things that there's been studies in New York City, as I'm sure you know, about the stop and frisk policies of the New York City Police Department, and I've read recently that the New York City Police Department in 2011 stopped and frisked more than 685,000 people, 88% of them innocent and 87% of them black and Latino. And the mayor of New York and the police department support this policy and defend it. Yet it's very clear from those statistics that there is an obvious case of racial profiling going on police beats across the city. How do you address that kind of systemic and continually defended policy on the part of police departments, not just in New York, but I'm sure all around the country?
I mean, yes, New York City is not unique in terms of the problem of racial profiling, although it is notorious for its stop and frisk policies, and just the number of stops that police officers make far exceeds, I think, any other jurisdiction in the United States. One of the things that that has been going on here in the city, in New York City, is a lot of activism among community-based organizations. There is a broad-based coalition called Communities United for Police Reform, which has been very active in trying to achieve reforms in the way that the New York City Police Department conducts itself in terms of stop and frisk, and for it to end its targeting of communities of color, the LGBTQ community, and other communities that have been targeted and harassed by police officers. There's also been several class action impact litigation that's been filed against the city challenging police practices. The Legal Defense Fund, in conjunction with our partners at the Legal Aid Society, have filed one. It's one that I just mentioned, challenging police practices in public housing and the way that they enforce the trespass laws. What our colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights have been litigating against the city, challenging the stop and frisk policy, saying that it is racially discriminatory. So there is a lot of activity going on because the rights at stake are so important, and also because of just the rampant constitutional violations that have been going on here.
You know, in addition to the stop and frisk law, I wonder, in your mind and the people you work with in New York and around the country, what's the most effective path towards institutional, cultural change within police departments to confront this this ongoing problem of racial profiling? Certainly, you mentioned citizen activism as one important element, but when it comes to state and federal government, what initiatives should be taken there to confront head-on the issue of racial profiling and the violence which often ensues from it?
I think a real acknowledgement that any type of effective policing really requires the building of trust and cooperation between the police department, any police department, any law enforcement agency, and the community that it's supposed to be protecting. And that's the problem with aggressive police tactics like stop and frisk, and also policies like racial profiling, because those types of practices really break down the trust. It causes hostility and distrust with community members, and community members lose faith in the police. They lose faith in the criminal justice system. There's no confidence that justice will be served, and so there needs to be a real effort to ensure that that trust is reestablished, and that all communities, and especially the communities of color that have been targeted for so long, that they feel confident and feel safe in collaborating with police officers for a common goal to prevent crime, because there really is a common goal here. The two sides shouldn't be at odds, like the way they feel like they are right now.
Chin Healy, the National Rifle Association, a very powerful lobby in Washington and in state capitals, along with ALEC, a national group that's sponsored by corporate organizations like Coca-Cola and ExxonMobil, are the ones that are pushing these the weakening of concealed gun laws and stand your ground laws from Florida and all across this country. What's your view of these laws and why they're being pushed so aggressively by these corporate backers and the NRA?
No, I can't possibly understand what their agenda is or why it is that they're pursuing these types of legislation. What I can say is that when that type of legislation is enacted in jurisdictions across the country, because they are embedded in a criminal justice system that is and has been inherently racist towards people of color, and when I say that, I mean that there is a lot of institutional discrimination against the Black and Latino communities when it comes to law enforcement. These types of statutes and laws just exacerbate the problem and create situations like we had with Trayvon Martin, where it gives institutions an additional excuse to not value the lives of our young Black and Latino men.
Well said, Jean Healy. And before you go, I just wondered, there's been an explosion of discussion about this Trayvon Martin case on our media, on cable TV talk shows, radio talk shows, in the newspapers. Do you think on whole this discussion, this national dialogue has been a positive, or do you see some problems here with the way some of the media are using this case and sensationalizing it or using it as a platform to direct more hatred at Black and Latino men?
Well, I think that like any issue, it's important for people when discussing anything that's controversial to be responsible in what they're saying and to be accurate in what they are saying. But I think that at the Legal Defense Fund, we've always our mission is to fight for the cause of racial equality, and with the knowledge that hasn't been achieved yet. And oftentimes the issue of race is pushed to the side or brushed to the side as if, that it's no longer a problem. People talk about a post-racial, America in the Obama age. And one of the benefits of what's happened here with the unfortunate death, and this is, when you think back, this the poor family Trayvon Martin's parents. You know, they've lost their son, and there's been this tragic death. But one of the benefits that can come from that is a national discussion about this issue, an issue that affects so many thousands of young people across the country, and hopefully will move legislators and policymakers and also community members to really reinstate reforms in the way that law enforcement behaves towards communities of color, and hopefully improve situations.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and I know you've got a lot more information on the website there at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. If you want to just leave us that web address or anything else that would be helpful in understanding these issues, that would be great.
Sure. Our website is NAACPLDF, and that's .org. That's for NAACP Legal Defense Fund, so NAACPLDF.org.
All right, Jean Healy, thanks so much for being here with us and your important work over there at the NAACP LDF.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Jean Healy, Assistant Counsel of the Criminal Justice Practice Group at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.